So I had one or two comments on what we had already covered, which was, if you go back to chapter 29, just because when I was looking over stuff, I caught one or two things that we didn't see. Verse 18. So you notice this is what Yaakov says. It says, Vayehav Yaakov et Rachel, Jacob loved Rachel, Vayomer, and he said to her, I will work 7 years, Birachel Bitcha Haktana, which means what? I'll work 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Why did he specify, a father doesn't know that Rachel's his younger daughter? Because, say the commentators, he knew what Lavan was like. And he wanted to get the terms down, and he wanted to specify, I'm talking about your younger daughter. And Lavan agrees, I mean, effectively. He doesn't say explicitly, I will give Rachel. Notice he says, it's better I give her to you. But Yaakov is so explicit because he's trying to write basically a foolproof contract because he knows who he's dealing with. So he says, Rachel, your younger daughter. So Lavan can't come back to him afterwards and say, well, you know, you said Rachel, but maybe you don't realize that she's younger and we don't give the younger. He agreed essentially to, I mean, later, of course, he doesn't stick to it. But it's one more reinforcement of the idea that Lavan is clearly deceptive and intending to be deceptive. And the other side of this is that I brought this morning Nechama Leibovitz with me. Those of you who have ever looked, Nechama Leibovitz, if you don't know, I've mentioned them before. She has a series of studies. They're all available in Hebrew on the web, although in English some of the books are available. Nechama Leibovitz was a teacher of Torah in Jerusalem, and they compiled her studies, and I'm going to read you from a little bit of her explanations today. She has a whole anatomy of Lavan's apology, which is very interesting, but we're not going to go into that right now. But he does have this. He says, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi posed two questions on this. First of all, why does Lavan say it's not done in our place that you put the younger for the older? Because he'd have a much stronger argument if he said, no one does this anywhere, which is true, right? Nobody marries the younger daughter before the older daughter, especially in the ancient world. I mean, even today, you know, when I do a wedding and there's an older child, the family's always concerned about the older child, right? Because when your younger sibling gets married first, so man or woman, it's always, but I mean, in the ancient world, it's really reinforced. So he says, why does he say that instead of saying no one does it? And the second question is, why did he prefer to say the younger tzi'ira before the older bechira instead of ketana before gedola? Ketana is small before big, because remember that Jacob says your katan daughter. He doesn't say your tzi'ir daughter. And the answer is what we talked about last time, right? He's, what Lavan is really communicating, says Rabbi Ashkenazi, is it's true in your place perhaps that such things are done, that the younger is given precedence and his portion is taken away and given to another, and the younger is given the name of firstborn, but such a thing is not done in our country, right? So if you analyze, you see, her comment is, if you analyze Lavan's speech carefully, you see that it really is clear that he's making an allusion to what Jacob did to Esav, right? But you have to look at it with care to see that it's not just a general idea, but that there are specific words that he uses that's supposed to remind Jacob of what he did. All right, so let's go on, and we'll come to the second difficult part about this, which is children. Children. And some interesting comments, especially from one guy I'll tell you about in a minute. Chapter 29, verse 31. Okay? Vayar Adonai kisnua Leah. I put that in particular because it says that Leah was unloved. But what is snua in Hebrew?
Hated.
Hated. And the question is, who hated her?
Jacob?
That's the obvious answer is Jacob, but that's a very uncomfortable idea. One Hasidic rabbi says, any guesses? Who hated Leah?
Rachel.
Leah hated Leah. When God saw that Leah was filled with self-loathing, that's when he opened her womb. Because Leah was unloved by her husband. And like many people, when someone who's supposed to love you doesn't love you, you internalize it, right? You don't think, most children who are not loved by their parents don't think, I can't believe I have a parent who can't love. They think I must be unlovable, right? That's what kids do. So spouses do that too sometimes, right? If the person who married me doesn't love me, it must be because I'm unlovable. Now, there's nothing that we've seen about Leah that's in fact unlovable. It's more in Jacob than in Leah, but what are you going to do? So God saw that Leah felt herself to be unlovable, so gave her children, which was a way of inducing Jacob to love Rachel. And it actually occurs to me, although I've never thought about it before, that although once or twice God fiddles with people's emotions, that is, he makes Pharaoh, for example, close-hearted and angry, I can't think of a time in the Bible, I don't know if you can, when God causes someone to love. Love always has to come from the person, right? I can't think of God forcing someone to love if they don't already love, which is kind of an interesting thing. So what does God do here? The best he can do is give Leah children in the hope that that will spark Jacob's love. And, you know, Joseph Telushkin once made a great comment to me about his kids. He said, you know you love your spouse when you see their qualities in your children and you're happy. So.
The last word. Though.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. If you say, oh my God, I can't believe your mother does that. But if you see the qualities of your spouse and your children and you're happy, that lets you know that you love your spouse, which I thought was a great comment. It depends what quality, of course. So the question is when Jacob saw Leah and her children, you know, what did it, because remember later on, who is it that Jacob loves? He loves Rachel's children, right? He loves Joseph. He loves Benjamin. And presumably it's because of Rabbi Telushkin's comment. He sees Rachel in them, and that's all he has left of Rachel, right? So he loves his children that much the more, but that's very sad for Leah. So there's a world of, you know, of family dynamics in that single comment. And if you think about it as Jacob being the one who hates Leah, it's that much sadder, right? If it's, but I think that's why the translation here chooses unloved, because unloved is, you know, gentler than hated. But when God saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Now this has completely changed the dynamic. Now Rachel, I mean, she may be loved, but, you know, presumably she's there to bear children. We'll come to that in a minute, about what she says and what the interpretation is. But the other part of it is that for the attentive reader of the Bible, this tells us something, because barrenness almost always precedes something wonderful, right? Barrenness and fullness in the Bible, we're about to come up on the book of Ruth. It's all about, you know, barrenness and fullness, emptiness, famine and plenty. I mean, think of Sarah, who was barren and then gives birth to Isaac, you know? And so the idea of, I'm trying to think of the psalm, the verse from the psalm, about the barren woman giving birth. It slips my mind, but I'll think of it. But that motif of barrenness and birth, it almost always lets you know that something, you know, remarkable or wonderful is about to happen. So the fact that Rachel's barren, it may be painful for her, but we who know the way the biblical stories work, we know that it's not going to stay that way forever. Leah conceived and bore a son and named him Reu, right? God saw my pain. The Lord has seen my affliction. It also means now my husband will love me. Again, this is probably where they derive the idea that Leah hated herself, because this is what she can do to have Jacob love her, right, is to give him children. And once again, the Reuven and Yehavani are, that's the connection between the two, Vain and Vaini, right? That's where he gets my husband, that's where she gets my husband will love me. The other thing that I'm thinking about is that this is actually the first time you've had competition between children, but you've never had competition between spouses. Hagar wasn't a spouse, right? So this is also, this is kind of the family dynamic moved up one generation, because who's the younger? Rachel. And once again, the younger usurps the older, right? Just like Isaac and Ishmael, just like Esau and Jacob, once again, Rachel and Leah, the younger usurps the older, which, by the way, is an idea that is going to be very appealing to a young new people, like the people Israel, who are among all these older, long-lived people. But as you know, later on was used by the church, right? They saw themselves as the younger child. Israel's the older child. The church is the younger child. God rejects the older child and has embraced Christianity as the younger child, right? So, yeah, it's almost like when your kids grow up, they use what you say to them against you, right? You always, things can be turned around and used for you or against you, depending on who's doing the interpreting. But Leah gives birth without any problem, and then gives birth again, right? She conceived again and bore a son, and declared, "This is because the Lord heard that I was unloved and gave me this one also." And so she called him Shimon, right? Which may be Shimu from Tahir, but the derivation isn't clear, at least according to Sarna. Okay. She conceives and bore a son and says, "This time my husband will become attached to me, for I've borne him three sons." Therefore, he was called Levi. Now, the reader here is, there are two things that you're getting from this, two main things. One is that with each child, she thinks Jacob will love her, right? And that's clearly, and that lets you know, even without saying it, that with each child, it's not working. Because if it worked with the first child, she wouldn't have to say with the later children, "Now my husband will love me," because he doesn't. And the other thing that you have to keep in mind is Rachel here, because Liz turning out kids, right, all the time, and Rachel is still barren. So her mounting frustration and Leah's mounting frustration, all of which derives from Jacob and Laban's, from Laban's deception and also Jacob's acquiescence, right? I mean, it's everybody's fault in a way. It's not any one person. Jacob didn't ask to marry Leah, right? But having married Leah, then he did ask to marry Rachel. So, and Laban has set it up also, which is worth thinking about. Laban set it up so that his children will be unhappy, right? By assuming that he knew what they wanted, or following the rules of the society rather than listening to who cared for whom, he actually set Leah up for this.
I'm thinking of Tina Turner. What's love got to do with it?
Well, in her life, very little, right? Because she married somebody who,
the rules of the road, which you just alluded to, is that everybody knew that the rule of the road was that love had nothing to do. And it was all about primogeniture, it's all about the senior, and we have three generations of Jews, bang, 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 and they all violate the law of primogeniture, the junior right. wins. So why wasn't there, it seems we had 2,000 years of winking at a myth. That the idea is to bury off kids without love, but our very patriarchs were consumed.
Except, well, it wasn't, it actually wasn't. In the Jewish tradition, it isn't that you don't, that love is irrelevant, because you can always reject a suitor.
Yes.
So it's not irrelevant. But it is true that the primary aim of marrying someone is to build a family. And that seems to be clearly what Abraham and Isaac understood. I mean, Jacob's is a love story, but that's rare in the Bible, right? Moses meets his wife, but there's no great love story. Even with Joseph, there's no great love story. But the point is that when there is love, it's essential not to pretend that it doesn't exist and to just override it as though it won't matter. And even more to have two wives, one of whom is loved and one of whom isn't, is really a prescription for, you know.
Your colleague Rabbi Feinstein comments that in Fiddler on the Roof,
mm-hmm.
She
right.
says, do you love
her? Right, and he says, I suppose I do. Right. Well, but that's a different, again, that's the classic idea of love, is that eventually you come to love because you take care of someone forever. And I would say the answer to that is that's absolutely true sometimes. Right? Right? But how many times is it true that you take care of someone for a long time and it does not increase your affection for them? Quite the opposite. So it's more complicated than any simple formula. It's not love. It's not building a family. It also depends on the temperaments of the people involved. You know, it can be all those things and different. Nobody's found a foolproof formula. So it's hard to figure out. I would say the traditional formula of you marry whom you're told to marry, basically, unless you really detest them, works for the society at the expense of a great deal of individual pain. Our formula works not as well for the society at the expense of a great deal of individual pain. So you see, it's a trade-off. And that's partly because, of what Virginia Woolf said about marriage. She said, people change and they forget to tell each other. You know? It's like when I see a couple in front of me, however well suited they are, I think to myself, neither one of them knows who the other will be or who they will be in 10 years. Because you can't know. You just can't know. So there's a certain element of luck involved. If you grow together, it's partly because you worked at it and all those other things, but it's also a certain amount of luck, because people grow in ways that you can't. And that's why, you know, that traditional wisdom of looking at your spouse's parents has something to say to it, because some people grow in the direction that we think of it now maybe more as genetics, but some people grow in the direction that their parents grow, or they become more like their parents as they get older, but not everyone does. So you can't, you know, there is no if there was a foolproof formula. But I will tell you this, by the way, which I also tell couples now. There was a long article in The New Yorker, as long as we're doing marriage counseling. This is fascinating. I'm sure they published a book, but I never followed it up. There was a psychologist who, with a team of researchers, he watched how thousands and thousands and thousands of couples fight. And he showed the tapes to clergy, to marriage therapists, asked them, is this couple going to break up, he said, and they had no better record than just someone off the street, because they hadn't actually broken it down scientifically, but he did, and he broke down the signals and so on, and he has some phenomenal percentage of being able to guess whether a couple will stay together or not. And the only thing that I remember from the article is that he said to the guy who was writing the article, he said, the predictor in a fight of whether a couple can stay together is not degree of anger, it's contempt. As soon as it becomes hierarchical, your opinion doesn't matter, you're nothing, he said, that couple's doomed. If it's just, I'm so angry at you, anger is okay. He says, what you can't contain is when someone devalues the other or thinks less of them or doesn't care about them. That, he said, is, and so, and I tell couples that because I want them to watch for that in each other. And you sometimes see, you know, a sort of startled recognition among them, seriously, that's what happens. So I found that very, and the reason that I bring it up is because of what's about to happen with Jacob and Rachel. And you'll have to analyze I don't think he expresses contempt, but it's a situation where he could. But you'll see what he says. Therefore he was named Levi. She conceived again and bore a son and declared, "This time I will praise the Lord." Therefore she named him Judah. Then she stopped bearing. Now what's significant about that? Who is Judah? Who does Judah become? He does, but more, keep going. The Messiah comes from Judah. He becomes the precursor of the Messiah, right? David comes from Judah. Judah is the one who has sex with Tamar, and that becomes the line of the Messiah. Remember, we'll get to that. But notice, Judah is born when? After she stops having children to get her husband to love her, and she starts to have a child because she understands that a child is a gift from God. And this child is not instrumental. She says, "This time I'm just going to praise God." In other words, I'm not going to use this kid to get my husband to love me. I'm giving a child to the world. And I understand that a child is actually not for my use. That a child has his own life and is a gift of God. And that's the one who becomes the precursor to the Messiah. Right? Yeah.
How is it drawn out that Jacob
That's a good question. I don't know. Jacob's out in the field. What can I say? Comes home. He says, "We had a kid today." Oh, really? What's his name? I don't have an answer to that, but that's a great question. Do you have a suggestion?
Well, I mean, the word that I use is hate. If he hates Leah,
maybe he doesn't.
He doesn't have a lot of affection
for her kids. It could be.
Actually, I was going to bring up there's a Hasidic teaching that the feelings that a couple have while making love affects their child. And so if he's hating the woman who's making love to it, it seems like it's going to affect the kids. And this is already affecting the next generation, even way before Joseph
is even born. Right. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I'm doing a lot of research on Mesopotamia. Could it be that I didn't come across this yet, but could it be that there was a tradition that the women named their children?
It could be. It could be. I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know if he has anything about it. No, God names Isaac, actually.
Yeah.
Remember? God says, "You did laugh."
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but it's an interesting question. I'm sure the answer is known. I just don't know it. The other question is, one second, because she gets, Rachel also gets to name Yosef, and presumably Yosef is loved. So it couldn't just be.
It seems like it's taken for granted that the
Yeah, because she names Yosef, so it couldn't just be that Jacob didn't want to have anything to do with it, because presumably he did want to have something to do with Yosef.
I think I read somewhere that had that right to name the child.
It could be.
But it's very ancient.
It could be. And then she stops bearing, v'ta'amod miledet, right? Which literally, she stood from birth. She's got four little ones, so she's busy. And then what, of course, happens is this very interesting exchange with Rachel. When Rachel saw that she'd borne Jacob no children, she became envious of her sister, first of all. The irony here, of course, is that her sister's envious of her. And each of them has cause to be, because each of them are fulfilling part of what they assume their life should be about. And this is the first exchange that we have here since they first met. Rachel said to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." Jacob was incensed at Rachel and said, "Can I take the place of God who has denied you the fruit of the womb?" So there's a lot to say about this exchange. The first is, what's Rachel saying to Jacob? Yeah, why is it his fault? Do you think that he's not having relations with her? Right? I mean, that seems very improbable that he's not having relations with his newly married wife whom he loves. And so, maybe, although why would he spurn her? I mean, she didn't do anything, right?
No, spurn, S-P-E-R-N.
What? Well, but she, in the ancient world, it's always assumed to be the woman. Just like, I mean, why do you think Henry VIII kept killing his wives, right? Seriously, because it was in the medieval world too, it was assumed that it was the woman. And if you didn't give birth, or if you gave birth only to girls, it was never assumed that it was the man's sperm. I'm sorry, what'd you say?
No, sure. But we know it's not a problem with the sperm.
Right, and he can, right, and we also know, right, that he can give, so he's going to assume, all right, how strange and unfeeling is Jacob's reply. Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, can I take the place of God who's denied thee the fruit of the womb? Our commentators, ancient and modern, have been puzzled. Didn't Jacob understand a person can't be blamed for what they say out of intense suffering? What fault did he find in her bitter complaint? Ramban, Nachmanides, says this. Okay, first of all, Jacob was angry because the prayer of the righteous, is not in their power that it must automatically and invariably be granted. In other words, for Ramban, the difference was Rachel assumed that Jacob didn't pray for her. Because if he prayed for her, God would have given her kids, because he's a righteous man. And Jacob was trying to explain to her the prayer doesn't work that way. You think I just pray for something and it happens? It doesn't work that way. I'm not all powerful. And the assumption that he was all powerful and just didn't care, and so he didn't pray, that was what incensed him, according to Ramban, which is a plausible, when someone gets upset at you for not doing something that you actually couldn't do, right? It's upsetting, especially when it's this important. One second. And then it says, I'll leave that out for the second, but we'll come back to it. There's another, this one I really want to, this is great. Okay, this is the one I wanted to read, Akedat Yitzchak. Now, Akedat Yitzchak, Isaac Arama, was a medieval commentator. And this is what he says, and this I think is remarkably progressive for a medieval commentator. But he was a very interesting guy anyway. So he says, the two names for woman are Isha and Chava, right? Woman and Eve, literally. I'll say woman and Eve. They indicate two purposes. The first teaches that woman was taken from man, Isha, right? Stressing that like him, you can understand and advance intellectual and moral fields, just as the matriarch and many righteous women and prophetesses did, as is said in Proverbs 31 about the Eshet Chayil, right? The Eshet Chayil, remember, is not mostly about having kids, right? It's about doing things, right? She weaves and she does this and she speaks words of wisdom. So he says there are two functions to women. One is the identical function to men, right? Which is to advance wisdom in the world, basically. Okay? The second alludes to the power of childbearing. That's what Eve is, right? And rearing children, as is indicated by the name Chava. Remember what Chava means? Aim kol chai, right? She's the mother of all that's living. A woman deprived of the power of childbearing will be deprived of the secondary purpose of life and left with the ability to do evil or good like the man who is barren. In other words, women have both. They have everything men has and they have childbearing. If they lose childbearing, then what they're left with is everything men have, right? 17th century, by the way, Isaac Arama. Of both the barren man and the woman, Isaiah says, I have given them in my house and in my walls a name that is better than sons and daughters. Right? If you give someone a name that's better than sons and daughters, that means even if you don't have sons and daughters, they can have this name. Since the offspring of the righteous is certainly good deeds. Right? If you're a righteous person, you don't have children, your offspring are good deeds. Jacob was therefore angry with Rachel when she said, give me children or else I die. In order to reprimand her and make her understand this all-important principle, that she wasn't dead as far as their joint purpose in life was concerned because she was childless, just as it would be in his case if he had no children. very wonderful comment, right? And he was angry at her because she thought that her only purpose in the world was to bear children. And he loved her. And remember, he loved her before she had children. And here she is saying, I don't matter. And if I don't have children, I'm going to die. So, and that idea is first of all, it's a powerful idea, but it also speaks to something which actually probably reproduce that passage and have it handy. I think I will. I think maybe I'll send it out as one of the off the pulpits, because the idea that a woman who doesn't have children is therefore valueless still exists, right? It's not only an ancient idea. It's not only a medieval idea. It's also a modern idea. What's that? I don't know more, but at least as strong. The one thing that might make it more is that there are more options, right? Because people keep, you know, you can try all sorts of medical interventions. So it keeps that hope going longer and may frustrate you more. So in that sense, it may be more. But in the medieval and ancient world, it was very powerful, which is why, obviously, you know, again, to turn to the Henry VIII, which is kind of the locus classicus of this, you know, which was why he everyone got into so much trouble. Basically, you know, started the English Reformation because he couldn't have a male heir, which is kind of a strange thing. But nonetheless, so I thought that that was a wonderful passage to note. And it also does indicate what isn't so clear, which is why is Jacob angry instead of compassionate, right? That's what the commentators are struggling with here. And when he says, I'm not in the place of God, it's because I think of the first half of Rachel's statement, which is give me children. Yeah.
Maybe Jacob's also very hurt that his love isn't enough for her. You know, she's so unhappy that she wants to die, even though he loves her.
Which parallels anyone, can anyone think of a parallel for that? There is an exact parallel for that. I didn't think about it. That's exactly what Hannah's husband says to Hannah at the beginning of Samuel. Isn't my love greater for you than the love of children? And she's praying to God because she wants children. Because the truth is, it's not enough. And he has another wife who has all these kids. And it's not enough for Hannah. She wants a child. And he's hurt because, you know, I'm not enough. And I think that the answer to that would be that he might be enough for her if it weren't for Leah. The fact that he has another wife who has all these kids must be what makes her feel, you know, maybe if it were just the two of them, she wouldn't feel that way. But he obviously wants children because he keeps having children with her sister, which is, you know, I wonder what they were like when they were growing up. What?
And the handmaidens.
And, well, that's about to come. It hasn't happened yet. That's actually spurred by the fact that she can't have children, so she pulls a Sarah, right? When Sarah couldn't have children, she brings out Hagar. Yes? It could be that she doesn't, right, it could be that if her purpose for having a child is to compete with Leah, then she doesn't understand, right, the purpose of having a child, although, look, people have children for all sorts of reasons, and social status is among them. I mean, you know, what your peers do influences you in ways you can't even imagine, and I bring as evidence this morning's New York Times, I think it was, where it talked about how people quit smoking in groups. That they traced it, and people have a much higher incidence of quitting if people around them are quitting. But if people around them aren't quitting, as anybody who has ever smoked knows, it's much harder to quit smoking when everybody around you is smoking, right? So anyway, the same thing here. Everybody around her is having children. Right.
And the complexes that women have in life about not being the beautiful one, I mean,
yeah.
Queen Esther,
that's right.
She's so beautiful.
Yep.
Rachel is Rachel because she's beautiful. And women are anorexic because they want to get beautiful.
Yep.
And that's how the definition is. And the other way is to have children. And if those are the two main things here, C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, I think, was the first one, to me, was the first person that spoke really to the envy of the other sister.
Mm-hmm.
Because this myth of Psyche and the other sister and who's the beautiful one of Cinderella, these are themes, and Western culture.
Well, it's clear. I mean, it's right here. The envy of the other sister is right. I mean, it's explicit here. And the look, it's still true. It's less true than it used to be. But beauty is a woman's earning power, you know, as success is a man's earning power. And that's what I get. Again, to return to the couples that come to my, and sometimes the single people that come to my office, here's the complaint. The woman will say he only cares about how people look. And the man will say she only cares about how much money I make. And they're all, I mean, and it's like, well, we're back 5,000 years ago, you know, because those societal tropes are still very powerful. They're still very powerful, and they're not easily overcome. And everybody who protests, and this is what that woman who came here, Lori Gottlieb, was talking about. And that was so, I mentioned this before, but it was so interesting. I'll mention it one more time. This is the woman who wrote that article called Settling for Mr. Good Enough, right? And she's 40-something now, and she has a child, but she has a child of her own because she never got married. And she said, you know, people that I rejected in my 20s now are married and they have families. And I think to myself, you know, I rejected him because he squeezed the toothpaste from the middle of the tube or because I didn't like his smile. And now I think that was so stupid because of what we were talking about before, building a family. And all these women who were there, and it was mostly women, there were a few men who were there, but mostly women, who were in their late 30s or early 40s, were all nodding and agreeing and so on. And the only person who took like almost violent issue with her, was really upset with her, was a young woman in her 20s, in her early 20s, who had just moved to Hollywood, who said, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm never going to settle. I'd rather live alone than. And she said, I felt that way too when I was in my 20s, but it doesn't. The world doesn't look the same when you're in your 30s and 40s. And she said, you know, I don't know, that may be for you, but it's not for me. And we all thought, you know, it's silly to make fun of her because the truth is that she was expressing what was age appropriate, and we would have said the same thing. So it's just about being at different stages. But it's, you know, it's as old as human beings and as new as human beings. So, yeah.
The funny thing is that she blames him, and then he blames her. He says,
right.
Is it my fault that God doesn't want you to have it? So there's three elements. There is jealousy,
mm-hmm.
Rachel Sulea, then there is, she's been, like, three midots that are really negative.
Yes.
And it just shows like there's like self-sabotage going on. I mean, it's funny, with Abraham, he was waiting to have a child, finally had a child. So then you would think the next generation when you have children, everybody happy.
Right.
That's right. And then you still think next generation when you have many children, now we have a big family, will be happy. You're still not happy, so.
It's like in the election, you always want the president who's the opposite of the president you had before, right? I mean, it's true. I mean, people are always voting for the qualities the previous president didn't have. So the same thing here. Everybody's looking for the family that isn't. And the rabbis point out, this is a beautiful comment too. The rabbis were actually, in the Talmud, they condemn Jacob for his answer, right? They don't defend him, at least some. And they say there are two times when someone says, can I take the place of God? Once it's said for the good, and once it's said for the bad. Here, Jacob says it for the bad. Can anybody pluck for, I don't know that I would have been able to do it with just that, pluck from their memory where? Who says, do I take the place of God? And says it to his brothers. There's a big hint. Joseph, when he says, you may have sold me here, you know, I'm not going to take the place of God and judge you. You may have sold me here for bad. It's in chapter 50. I'll read you the exact context. Chapter 50, verse 19. Okay, this is what Jacob, and there they say Jacob said it for good. Jacob said it to bring families together. Joseph, I'm sorry, thank you. So Joseph went to bury his father, and with him all the officials and so on and so forth. Chapter 50, verse 19, if you want to look with me, but you don't have to. And here we are. His brothers went to them themselves, flung themselves before him and said, we're prepared to be your slaves. But he said to them, have no fear. Am I a substitute for God? Right? It's God's judgment. It's not my judgment. I'm not going to do this to you. So he took what Jacob said to Rachel in a slighting way, right? And he repaired it. He did a tikkun, basically, right? You take something in the world that was done badly and you make it good. And Jacob made it good by using it to heal rather than to hurt, which is a very nice, you know, leave it to the rabbis. The one thing that the rabbis always do is they know the Torah so well that any echo of one phrase somewhere else, they just naturally hear it because they remember the Torah constantly. So when they hear this phrase, they remember that one. And that's a very nice idea. Now, before we wrap it up, let's just talk about what Rachel does. Jacob was incensed to Rachel. Can I take the place of God who's denied you the fruit of the womb? She says, here's my maid, Bilhah. Consort with her that she may bear on her knees and that through her I too may have children. She gave her maid Bilhah as a concubine and Jacob cohabited with her. Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. And Rachel said, God has vindicated me, heeded my plea and given me a son. Therefore she named him Dan. Dan is from judgment, right? Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again, a second son, and that's Naphtali, right? A fateful contest I waged with my sister, and I have prevailed, she said. So she's really made it, right? Very competitive. And also, what interests me about this in part is that when Joseph is sold into slavery, Dan and Naphtali aren't on his side. They're with all the other brothers. So in fact, what Rachel doesn't realize now, and actually she never realizes because she dies before it happens, is that she didn't succeed in creating, not through her handmaid. The whole handmaid thing is always, I advise against it. It's always problematic, yes.
That's what you tell all these couples.
That's what I tell all these couples. Don't go the handmaid route. So really, I advise two things. One is pay according to Social Security. It's proper. And the other is don't. That should be it. Yeah.
It's strange because who are you closer to, your sister or your handmaid? I mean, she could have felt she's a mom through her niece.
Right. It's true.
Child of a maid, you know what I mean?
Yes. Right. There is. I mean, it's destroyed. The rivalry has destroyed the connection between the sisters, which is sad. Yeah.
This might be like a naive question, but through all of this, Jacob just seems to be willing to sleep with whoever. And there's never any commentary about right. the fact that he's doing it.
Well,
I mean, if my husband had done that, I would leave him.
Right.
But it's a different
so
time.
It's interesting right. that throughout the Torah, we don't have any.
Well, first of all, it's a polygamous society. So the reason you would leave your husband is because there's an understanding of monogamy. But there isn't an understanding of monogamy. It's a polygamous society. He's married both of them. They know that. And Rachel brings him her handmaid. And Leah later is going to do the same thing. And you get a sense that this is all about who can have the most kids. And the husband is a breeder, right? And to some extent, this may have to do with economics. In a place where you need lots of children, you need lots of women to produce lots of children. In a society where producing children is optional, basically, and isn't needed economically, monogamy is affordable. But in an ancient world where you need lots of children to work the land, especially because many will die, they may not have been able to afford monogamy, even though we think it's a good idea, right? So I don't know if that's true, but it's at least one way of looking at the possibility of why would you have a polygamous society? Because you needed lots and lots of children, first because a certain number of them were going to die, and second because you had land to work and you had all of this, whereas now, as you know, I mean, have you ever wondered why it is that we keep kids in college until their mid-20s? The answer is because the workforce can't absorb them. What would happen if tomorrow, all of a sudden, at age 12, everybody got a job? What would happen to all the people at the far end of the workforce? They would all have to leave. I mean, one of the reasons we have monogamy is because in a developed society, it holds birth rate down. And one of the reasons we have this extended education is because we're not ready for all those people to come. I mean, most of the people who get educations in college don't. They don't end up doing what they did in college. They don't need to some extent, right, to have that education. But society needs them to. So it's a very, it's just one other way of looking at it, is it's not only a moral question, it's also a social and economic question about how many kids you have. So, yeah.
Does Jacob have daughters?
Yeah, he does later on, right. Dina becomes, the daughter becomes very central in a story. But they're only talking about, right, the boys, because that's what they're trying to, you know, that those are the ones who inherit.
Named those kids, basically it's such a negative thing because it interferes under the rest of your life.
Right.
That you know, let's say somebody has a kid by mistake and they call them mistake.
Right.
And for the rest of your life, your name is mistake, and that's it. This is what your identity is.
Yeah.
Doesn't give you even a chance to change your identity.
That's true.
And dooms you. So what do the rabbis ever talk about? This.
Yes and no. I mean, the names, all the names are important, and they consider the names important. I don't remember any rabbinic discussion about the fact that your name follows you through life in a bad way, except, I mean, there's Naval, for example, in the book of Shmuel. There's Naval, which means a fool, right? And his wife, after he offends King David, his wife says to King David, Kishmo Kenhu. He is what his name says, right? So I guess that's true. I don't know. Maybe that's why you get that Dr. Seuss story about the woman who has all these children and names them all Dave, right? It's a good, very funny story, right?
Well, there is a tradition that if you're sick and are not
right, then you change your name.
Then you change your name, yeah. And that's somehow it seems that your fate is associated with your name.
Yeah. Yes, there was a.
Well, no, I was.
Go ahead. You can change your name, and there is this tradition, right? Some people will add the name Chaim or Chaya to their name if they're sick. It's based on the idea that, you know, the angel of death comes for a specific person. And if you change your name, you'll say, oh, well, that's, you know, it wasn't you, right? You can do it. You can change your name otherwise, too. Right, you can. You can absolutely do that, yes.
Did Jacob marry these handmaids?
Doesn't seem it, no.
And what do we draw from their not being Jewish and the offspring?
Well, until the time of Ezra, it really seems to follow, to some extent, the father. And I say to some extent because, like with Sarah, it followed the mother, right? Isaac, Abraham had lots of kids. It was only Sarah's son who became Jewish. But the 12 tribes follow the father, although the rabbis assume that Bilhah and Zilpah, the handmaidens, that they converted. It doesn't say it in the Bible, but the rabbis assume they converted, which is not, by the way, an unreasonable assumption, because when you come into the home of somebody in the ancient world, you adopt their ways. So presumably, if they were Rachel and Leah's handmaids, that they would have taken on their, you know, their traditions and so on. Because being their handmaids, remember, it wasn't like, you know, they showed up at 9 and left at 5. Right, they really were part of the, oh, Zilpah, she's part of the family. You know how people introduce their housekeepers that way? You know, Zilpah's been with us for 20 years, she's really part of the family. Aren't you, I used to love that. Aren't you Zilpah? Yes, Mrs. Wolpe, you know. But with the handmaids then, they really were parts of the family. So, yeah, anyway. All right, see you next Thursday.
Thanks.